Good day from Wall Street. This is Jack Marks for Wall Street Reporter, and today I am speaking with John Textor. He is the CEO of FaceBank Group. Stock symbol is FBNK. John, welcome.
Thank you, Jack. It's great to talk to you again.
Absolutely. And next week, FaceBank is going to be a featured presenter at Wall Street Reporter's next Superstock Conference. That's going to be February 13th. And definitely anybody listening should click the registration, sign up to get the, to join the presentation live and hear more from John. But today's interview is really going to give investors a sort of a sneak preview of what the company is all about, to get to know you as the company leadership. As most investors who follow the next Superstock conference know, our goal is to bring companies to investors that have massive opportunities, companies going after huge markets, stocks with 10x upside potential. So based on that, I think anybody listening to this interview is going to be impressed. So John, let's kind of get started. Before we get into the FaceBank story, all the details, can you tell our audience about your background and how you got involved with the company?
Yeah, no, thank you, Jack. Much of my early background is actually coming to a surprisingly high amount of relevance in our current business model. Things I did back in the late 80s, early 90s. I'm old enough to have seen the beginning of the internet when, thank God, Al Gore invented it, as we've come to know. And a lot of that's coming to play in this deal in particular. FaceBank is a digital human technology company, but it's very much not just about the exciting uses of a face, how a celebrity might employ their face commercially, creatively. Consumers now doing the same thing. We're the selfie generation. And so when you start thinking about that, protecting assets, making those available for use while keeping them secure for the benefit of the content owner, in this case, the celebrity or the consumer, I actually first started learning a lot about that, I think probably back in 1997. I was coming out of the investment banking world. I learned how to buy a company, how to raise capital. But I was always a programmer. From age 16, I sold my first program to a bank, and I was coding kind of in my dorm room. I was lured to Wall Street because that's kind of what you did in 1987. But I was thrilled to see the world start connecting, as we saw in the mid-90s, with the advent of networking and the internet, consumer, excitement over the internet. And the first company that I was involved in, we actually helped save it. It was a company called ART Technology Group. Stock symbol back then was ARTG, and SoftBank was their major shareholder. They dropped them. They were running out of money. They hadn't made payroll in a while, and we showed up. I organized a group of Wesleyan friends. I went to Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut. I cobbled together some money. It ended up being probably a top five IPO in 1999, reached a liquid $10.5 billion market cap. We backed the management team of Jeet Singh and Joe Chung, and that was a personalization company. They basically invented, what we know is very common today. You sign onto a website and you're recognized immediately, your history with that company, your browsing and purchasing preferences. The cool thing about the internet, it wasn't that long ago. Somebody had to invent all of this stuff, and ART Technology Group was one of the very first companies to allow websites to interact on a one-on-one basis with the individual. And that's called personalization. And what we're going to talk a lot about at FaceBank is, when you have the assets of an individual, whether it's a celebrity face or a consumer face, and they go off into the world playing around in virtual reality or social media apps, how do you protect those assets? How do you prepare those assets for use and enjoyment? And how do you personalize their experience to maximize their fun or their commercial opportunity? Shortly after our technology group, I think we probably looked a lot smarter than we were. That meant I got invited into a whole bunch of cool technology projects. The $2.4 million that I organized for my Wesleyan friends, we returned $550 million in cash
Wow.
In just 3 years. Wesleyan was very happy because I created a bunch of new donors from the class of 87. And we went on to create a bank called Virtual Bank, which was one of the very first internet banks. And it was started largely because we understood, you know, the internet and web experiences and how people's lives were changing via the web. So launching a bank from the very beginning, not a website on top of old legacy, you know, Bank of America kind of software. But really, if you were building a bank from scratch on the internet, how would you do it? What would it look like? How would you secure data? And Virtual Bank ended up bringing quickly about $4.5 billion in consumer deposits. We noticed one of our first customers was Bill Gates. You know, the guys at Microsoft ended up becoming shareholders of our company. We started the Microsoft Virtual Bank, the WorldCom Virtual Bank. So we were the in-house internet bank for Microsoft employees, WorldCom employees, Textron, EMC. VirtualBank.com is still around today. We sold out a long, long time ago, but it's still around today. So I'm very proud of that business. It's owned by Iberia Bank now. And so that taught me a lot about how to protect digital assets. You know, the idea that you could be a bank and protect somebody's money and not have a branch location, not have a vault. Now we call it cryptocurrency, and you know, we protect
fintech,
it not in a server,
right?
Environment, but this, you know, via the blockchain.
Yeah, this is
so, from our technology group to Virtual Bank to you know, I guess some of the more fun kind of consumer technologies, and then my partnership with one of my Wesleyan housemate, Michael Bay, became a great film director, and together we developed really cool technologies to change feature films as we know them today. Jack, I don't want to go on forever about myself. If you'd like me to dive into that a bit.
Sure. It's interesting. You were very early into these technologies, like, you know, in terms of the virtual bank. I mean, this was, I guess now they call it fintech, right? You were doing this 15 years ago plus.
Well, we founded Virtual Bank in probably the toughest quarter ever. It was planned well in advance, but we launched in May of 2000, right at the kind of end as we knew it. And, you know, I was very committed to the internet because I didn't care so much about the crash. There was no internet crash. There was a valuation crash, but the internet every day was changing lives and the way people, you know, interacted with each other and conducted commerce and went about their lives. So we went ahead and launched in May 2000, you know, one of the very first internet banks in history, along with a couple of others back then, like Wingspan. And you know, everybody thought it was a bit crazy. They thought we'd fail. And I'd say the disappointing thing about Virtual Bank is we made a ton of money for our shareholders. It became more of a bank than a software company. But in the end, we built a really valuable business. I'm sure had that business been founded, you know, a couple of years earlier, it would have been one heck of an IPO. But now I'm proud to say it's just a 20-year successful business that's helped a lot of people, you know, as a pure internet bank.
So,
and, you know, from there, look, I've been, you know, more relevant to FaceBank. I'm building characters in, you know, entertainment technology applications. You know, I've gotten a lot of attention for early contributions and pioneership of virtual reality. Not even a big fan of virtual reality as much today, though, you know, it's nice that I'm finally getting credit for stuff that happened 20 years ago. But I'm about the user. I helped produce a film called Tron Legacy. I did an $80 million visual effects project there. And if any of you remember that film, the first one or the second one, which we did, you know, it's all about the user. And if you remember that in technology, don't fall in love with the contraptions and the new technologies. Just pay attention to what the consumer's doing, what they're going to need today, what they're going to need tomorrow, you know, how their preferences change over time, and making sure you're giving them the tools to, you know, continue to expand, you know, their relationship with you over time. So, you know, whether it's protecting data, protecting cash, personalizing the experience, you know, the internet enabling technologies, which have helped consumers and people around the world, you know, enjoy the web, enjoy each other, conduct commerce, engage in creativity, social apps, communication. It's all about the user. And that's been my focus throughout my whole life.
Okay, and you've got involved in the visual effects, special effects industry, and that kind of transition to FaceBank. So can you talk about your background and that, some of the projects you've been involved in, some of the awards and all that stuff?
Yeah, so that also started very early. In virtual reality, I was building 3D worlds, 3D chat rooms. They back then, they looked a lot like what we're used to today, video games, multi-user experiences, where people are dialing into a common environment and you're cruising around the world and you see other users. And so I started building some of those worlds for my partner's movies, the promotional experiences for his films. Michael directed Armageddon, Pearl Harbor, The Rock, and we built the user experience for the movie Pearl Harbor, and Disney promoted it. And I started to see how, honestly, the characters, didn't look as good as I thought they should. And I became very focused on not only visual effects, the environments and explosions and world destruction, the fun things you see in film, but I really focused on character a lot, from those early ugly geometric avatars that we had in virtual reality to full hyper-realistic digital humans, like the character that we built for The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. Along the way, I led the visual effects projects for 25 major films, from Pirates of the Caribbean, At World's End, Transformers, Tron Legacy, Real Steel, Benjamin Button, a long, long list, Iron Man 3. And so I just fell in love with that, right? I was a technology guy. I was a programmer. I was a 3D programmer. And now I wasn't dealing with kind of the ugliness of the early internet, where it was hard to push high quality visuals down a really slow modem speed. And I was working in the film environment where there were no bandwidth considerations and we could make things look perfect. We didn't have to compromise. So as the chairman of a digital domain, I bought a company from James Cameron. Multiple parts of that business were wildly successful. Other parts of the business on the services side, unsuccessful, then reborn in Hong Kong as a $3 billion IPO. But we won 8 Academy Awards at Digital Domain under my leadership for incredible films. And but the thing that I really love more than anything, which ultimately led me to FaceBank, is building characters. So the hyper-realistic, Brad Pitt in The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, people didn't know this, but the first 52 minutes of the movie, there was no Brad Pitt. It was a digital character that was so believable. It also won the Academy Award for Best Makeup, as if it were a human character. So obviously we fooled people. We went on from that to build Jeff Bridges' younger character in Tron Legacy and the Tupac hologram. And then ultimately, that's what got me into, digital celebrities. The Michael Jackson hologram, if you will, and, now the projects we're doing at FaceBank.
So let's dive right in. I mean, FaceBank, from what I've read, it's an incredible story here. So tell our audience exactly, what does FaceBank do? What's the business of FaceBank?
It's one of those jobs where I'd say, somebody's got to do it, and nobody was doing it. Everybody falls in love with the next great way to deliver content, and I've seen the world go from the fights between VHS and Betamax to, VR, one kind of a platform against another. Now the advent of the AR, augmented reality. And so as I look at my life and the development of technology to enhance consumer experience, either across the internet or across entertainment, and I see the confluence of those worlds where, everything really is about entertainment and content. Even advertising is changing. We're not going to watch an ad unless it's funny, unless it's entertaining. We're not going to spend any time on a website unless, there's a reason to be there, to stay there. Are we laughing? Are we learning? So, as the world evolves, people fall in love with the next great mousetrap. It was now that the virtual reality had a huge comeback, which surprised me. Frankly, I think the only reason is Facebook decides to buy Oculus and everybody assumes that Zuckerberg is smarter than the rest of the world. So suddenly VR is hot again. I think some of the smarter companies know the limitations of VR, the installation, the adoption by consumers of headsets and you know, really the absorption of that kind of content. I think, you know, smart money's moved on to augmented reality. But I guess from my perspective, as I've seen it all from, you know, the late 80s to now, and I still consider myself a builder, a technology architect, if not a programmer anymore, you know, what can I build that's really valuable that is going to stand the test of time? And the one thing that I've seen from traditional entertainment to the internet to virtual reality to augmented reality, from feature films to theatrical, it's the user, it's the human, whether it's the human watching or the human acting. In all these worlds that we're talking about, whether it's feature film or virtual reality or augmented reality, whether you're performing or watching, there's going to be a human involved. And increasingly, it's obvious that human is not going to be made of flesh and blood. They're going to be digital. And somebody's got to be their builder. Because if I leave it alone and let somebody else do it, I think it's all going to look like crap, right? I believe that we are capable of building the most beautiful, compelling, engaging, interactive, hyper-realistic digital humans in the world. And those characters are going to be usable from traditional entertainment to feature films to video games to virtual reality to augmented reality to now what we're talking about, which is mixed reality, VR, AR to XR. And what's the one thing that nobody's really paying attention to? It's the digital human that is pervasive. You're either going to come across a human that is representing another user or an entertainer, or it's going to be a bot, an artificially intelligent bot conversing with you and either in a video game or in a learning experience, a digital assistant, a virtual influencer. So I just love that space. I've always loved character, and I've seen the world evolve from really ugly polygonic, you know, cartoons to hyper-realistic characters that are incredibly engaging. I know Siri, Alexa, they're going to have a face very, very soon. When you talk to a computer and ask a question, you're going to get an answer, and it's going to come from a digital human, not just a voice box. So I think that's it's a survivable business model. But let me tell you, I think the most important point, I look at all of my business successes and I look at my one failure, and where was my failure? It was a services business where we were building incredible things to drive somebody else's intellectual property, somebody else's film, somebody else's game. That's not a model I care to be in. And you see so many people in the VR, AR space are jumping on it. It's huge. It's growing. I love it. And they're providing a technology or a service, or they're helping build the next mousetrap. Well, technology fades quickly. It becomes obsolete quickly. Intellectual property lasts forever. And in our business model, we're building digital human likenesses for major celebrities and for now consumers. So the way that we built Benjamin Button and won the Academy Award in 2009, we're not even using those techniques today. But there's still only one Brad Pitt, only one Michael Jackson, only one Elton John, only one Elvis Presley, only one David Beckham. So we're a technology-driven IP model. We are a digital human company and a digital human technology company, but our focus is on IP. And we're the first company in the world that I know of that not only sees celebrities as having intellectual property, but the consumer has intellectual property. Your face is your asset. Facebook is facing a $35 billion lawsuit right now for the misuse of the facial assets of their consumers. And we have Elvis Presley to thank for this, by the way, because it was the lawsuits in 1982 that defined one's likeness as their asset. So, you know, people always want to ask me, well, when's Elvis coming back? Or when's, you know, Muhammad Ali coming? Or, you know, how about Bob Marley? But I'm more interested in the 2 billion consumers around the world that are scanning their faces into their phone just to unlock their phone. And they're not even thinking about where their digital assets are going, who's protecting them, how they're going to be used. And I think they need to be protected for the benefit of the consumer. I think we can do that in ways that we didn't even understand back in the days of virtual bank. Blockchain protocol allows you to truly lock down the assets of the individual. And the individual can decide when you want to download your face into a video game, send it to your mom in a digital greeting card, have your own, you know, customized animoji. This is the selfie generation, and your digital selfie is so much more fun, so much more deployable, and so much more usable. It's now replacing your fingerprints, your social security number. It's a face ID that you can get onto an airplane with, right? So the face is important. It's your asset. And yes, You know, we have an incredible and growing portfolio of digital humans that represent celebrities that, yeah, they'll go on stage, they'll be in film, they'll be in video games. But the largest intellectual property portfolio I've ever contemplated is the world of human faces scanned, protected, activated for creative enjoyment, fun, commercialization for every connected consumer around the world. So FaceBank literally is the extension of what I learned at Virtual Bank, but now we're going to protect your face.
So how do you monetize
this? Give us
your
face. How do you monetize it? Well, the boring side of it is, to start, you know, what do you do at a bank? You put your assets at the bank. As you access those assets, you know, they're micropayments and things that irritate you, but that's how banks survive. But it's when you put your face in play that it gets really interesting. So let's say you scan your face with us. We're storing it for you. And we did a test through a related company. A good friend of mine, Kevin Weston, did this in the St. Louis Mall. Put a kiosk in the middle of the mall, scan little kids' faces. They would walk into the booth. It was a lot of fun, music playing. They walk out, and their face is suddenly in a video game video. They pay $10, and they walk away with it, and they see themselves in an experience. And then 2 weeks later, 1,200 of these little girls in just one weekend, a Saturday and Sunday, ordered their likeness through a 3D printer on an action figure doll that was sent to them a few weeks later so they can play with their character and Barbie or G.I. Joe. Now, that's just one example. But when the consumer starts, you know, thinking about, well, what can I do with my face? I'd like to see myself with a beard. I'd like to see myself as an action figure. I want a realistic version of me. I want a video game avatar of me. Well, every time they come back to us and say, okay, FaceBank, send my face to Microsoft. I want to download it into a video game. Well, that's a micropayment fee for us. Every time they want to upgrade it, turn themselves into a superhero, that's an upsell. And anybody that knows the video game space knows that kids cannot sit on one avatar for more than a couple of days before they want to pay to get the new avatar, a new, you know, set of digital clothing, a new hat. Millions and millions and millions of dollars is made by video games like Fortnite and others because people want to customize. So when consumers start using their faces and sending digital greeting cards and building their futuristic alter ego, if you go to our website at facebankgroup.com, on the front panel, there's a section called The Future of Your Face. Just look at what people are doing with their faces. I'll give you one other example. There's a makeup try-on app that was created by a friend of ours that we built the Benjamin Button character with. They made $30 million of revenue and $24 million in profit on one app called the L'Oreal Makeup Genius, scanning women's faces and allowing them to see what they look like in different shades of makeup and lipstick. So just settle a bit and think about it. This is the selfie generation. We're infatuated with our likeness. We put right. bunny ears on it and dog noses on it. And so every time they touch their face, upgrade their face, whether we're charging them a penny or, you know, 5 cents or $40 for the doll, or as I discussed with the people at Elton John's management team, you show up at a concert, why buy the t-shirt that says you were there? Because the t-shirt you buy can have you sitting at the piano with Elton playing Yellow Brick Road. So when people start activating their likeness in all these fun physical products, digital products, is a tremendous amount of money. Now on the celebrities, I'm sorry to go long on this question, but I actually should have led with this because, you know, what we're doing now today is we're signing celebrities all the time. We've got a big announcement coming next week. More celebrities are signing onto the platform and they have actionable projects, you know, where, you know, they can perform. We've got a partial interest already in Kung Fu Panda, where the company that we have an interest in owns the rights to the Kung Fu Panda character for theatrical across all of Asia. And so the way we build emotions and a dynamic performance into a digital human is the same way we would build it into the face of a panda. Our technology doesn't care the shape of your face or whether it's got skin or fur. And so Kung Fu Panda is really a theatrical property. Floyd Mayweather, it's up on our website. We've hinted a little bit about what this might be. I'd say we're probably the most under-promoting OTC company in the world because we put it into an 8K, but we still haven't done a release on it. But you can go to our website and imagine Floyd Mayweather, the hyper-realistic simulated boxer fighting Sugar Ray Leonard and settling the questions that, you know, everybody always has wondered, you know, who would win that fight if both of them in their prime. So imagine a hyper-realistic Floyd Mayweather fighting Sugar Ray Leonard in a world pay-per-view event. Nobody knows the result, but maybe the 10 animators that we shove in a closet for the 6 months it's necessary. Muhammad Ali versus Mike Tyson. So on the celebrity side, they have some really cool projects that they have in mind, some that we've helped bring to them, some that come from the world of creative that's inspired by our Tupac performance or a Michael Jackson hologram. So those are the big revenue, big cash flow projects that we expect to see in 2020. The consumer stuff, we're really just starting our consumer scans in the second quarter of this year, and that's going to take a little bit longer. So celebrity excitement now, consumer global kind of relevance and scalability later.
So the celebrity, IP portfolio. So you have, so maybe you can get into some more details of like how, like some of the projects and what we could expect in the next like 12 months.
Yeah, you mentioned Mayweather. I'm glad you asked the question because I probably should have started with like how we are aligned with those celebrities. We did not want to be a services provider that helps the celebrity go do great things. We wanted to own a piece of the IP. But in the case of a celebrity, you can't own their face unless they sell it to you. What's more likely and what we've been doing are these terrific revenue share agreements where we're completely aligned with a celebrity. Now, we don't know how digital Michael Jackson is going to be used in the future, whether he's going to perform in a concert or be in a Pepsi commercial, you know, or, you know, something that we produce. But we own 40% of the revenues that would go to the estate. So we have a revenue share with the estate, 40% with Michael Jackson, 25% of Mayweather, and three very, very big celebrities that we're announcing next week, all at 25%. And, you know, I think that's the right way to be aligned. I mean, we're aligned with the celebrity. We want to make money when they do. You could never walk up to Elvis Presley in his life and say, we want 25% of your appearance fees and what you make at tonight's concert. You know, but you can now, because what we're bringing to them are incremental revenues that they never imagined. You know, where can digital Marilyn Monroe go in life, and who's going to pay her, you know, to be in a print ad, to be in a you know, theatrical show? So we're structured, our ownership of IP and the celebrity thing is actually in the form of revenue share agreements. And if we weren't really good at what we do, one, we wouldn't be getting the A-listers because they have choices. You know, we compete against Lucas and Sony Image Works and Digital Domain, my old company, but we're winning these lead relationships. I submit that we're the best builders of hyper-realistic digital humans in the world. That may or may not be true, but it seems to be true because we're getting all the big ones. Now, the whole music hologram space that I accidentally invented, I'm kind of embarrassed about it. They're signing Amy Winehouse and Roy Orbison. We're signing the Elvis Presleys of the world. So, and we own a piece of what they make in huge percentages. Virtual ABBA, we own the lesser percentage of that. It's just a different deal. There are four of them. They're alive. We have 5% of ABBA, and you'll see them, frankly, coming to the world in 2020. And you go to our website to read about that. They actually gave us credit in the press for bringing them back together as a band because they're so excited about the project. So I think we're important to pretty important IP, to pretty important celebrities, the world's best. And now we're going to take that to consumers.
So, but let's little bit more about the celebrity side. So essentially you create, the digital version of, you know, one of these celebrities, and then you get a perpetual revenue share of whatever these digital
assets
are used
for. Well, in the case of Michael Jackson, there's no term at the end of the agreement. I mean, they do have the ability to buy us out at some point, but that contract goes for in perpetuity. Most of the agreements you have, they'll be 5 years or 3 years. And if you perform and they make a certain amount of money, you can extend again and again and again. But what we're trying to do is build up a catalog of celebrities, dozens and dozens of celebrities, where we're effectively like the talent agency for their digital likeness. But we get a much bigger percentage than a talent agency would get. Now, everyone is a bit different. You know, music celebrities have projects that are derived from the music hologram kind of inspiration, whereas people like David Beckham, they're just tired of going to photo shoots. He wants to have his life. He wants to have his soccer team that he runs. But he's incredibly valuable, especially in China, and he's constantly being asked to be in the next great, you know, print campaign. So we can send any version of a digital David Beckham that you want, you know, with razor stubble, with long hair, with sweat on his brow, and put him in any lighting. So they can put all the extras or the B-level actors in that photograph shoot. You know, they can photograph them. We'll send digital David into that application so he can stay home with his kids. I met with Kris Jenner, Kim Kardashian's mom. She loves the idea too. We don't have a deal with them, but we did do some work with Kanye, and he paid us. So everybody's got a different use. You know, it's when you're a celebrity, one of the easiest ways to sign these people is, you know, we do sort of take advantage of their vanity a bit. The meeting starts. We tell them their face is important. They agree with us. We say your digital face is even more important than your photographic analog face. They tell me about it. You show them a bit of the future, the projects that they can creatively or commercially engage in. And so we sign them into our catalog. But please understand, as much as celebrity excitement is important to our business, one celebrity is worth probably 100 million consumers sometimes. There was a Russian company that had a thing called the Face App, very simple tech, really cool. Scan your face and you see what you look like as an older person. Nobody cared about him until Drake, the rapper, scanned his face. And then suddenly, this little company, Face App, had 150 million consumers that scanned their face. Now, companies like that are great partners for us because you should have fun with your face and do all that, but you should give your face to us at FaceBank, allow us to protect the asset for you, and then we interoperate with, say, a Face App and let you have fun with your face in a beard or gray hair. But the last thing you want to do is scan your face and send it to a little company in, no offense to Russia, but in this case it was Russia. And before people knew it, 150 million people had unwittingly agreed to terms on the app that gave that company a royalty-free license in perpetuity on your face and all of the photos in your phone. So, you know, this is one of those moments where, you know, we were all a little dumb when we gave our names and email addresses too easily away to the internet back in, you know, the year 2000. Now we're scanning our faces into apps and we're not thinking about where those might be lost. So, yeah, celebrities are great, but frankly, a catalog of celebrities, all of our contracts now require the celebrity to promote FaceBank. You know, we're announcing a pretty attractive deal simultaneous with the release of this interview. So I can tell you it's with our existing shareholder, Authentic Brands Group. They have 265 million Instagram followers, and our contract with them obligates them starting in the spring to advertise FaceBank to every one of their 265 million followers every single month. Wow. So the celebrities are valuable, but they're more valuable in talking to the consumers because that's the big play.
Right. Well, and Authentic Brands, I mean, they're a private equity firm. I think they bought Sports Illustrated recently, right? I mean, they're very interested in IP.
Yeah, I mean, they are an IP company. If you go to AuthenticBrandsGroup.com, they own Elvis, Marilyn Monroe, Muhammad Ali. They've acquired rights to living celebrities like Shaquille O'Neal and Dr. J and Greg Norman. They own Volcom, Juicy Couture, Sports Illustrated. They just bought Barney's. So they're a massive $10 billion, you know, giant of brands, and they're an existing shareholder of the company. They've been shareholders for a while. They love us. We love them. I should say our other shareholders that are of significance, the Lego family, Tencent Holdings, they gave us $10 million. They own something called WeChat, which for those of you that know, that's the primary way people communicate in China. So
right.
We have access to potentially those customers as well. It's about 1 billion WeChat users. So we've got really cool shareholders that love the FaceBank concept and want to roll us out to their consumer audiences. Our goal is to have 1 billion faces scanned into the FaceBank app within the next 3 years. And it sounds like a crazy number, but when one little Russian software, you know, app can get 150 million faces in 3 weeks, I think it proves my point that people are really infatuated with their selfies. And we, through Authentic Brands Group, through Tencent Holdings, we have access to hundreds of millions of consumers that are already signed up consumers of our shareholders. So we're nicely backed, not only with shareholders that we're proud of, but shareholders that can give us access to their massive consumer bases.
I think that's you know, what's very compelling about the FaceBank story is, you know, this possibility of scaling up very rapidly to get, you know, those billion faces into your system. And, you know, we've seen this again, like you mentioned this example of the Russian company, but, you know, this happens overnight. I mean, this is like Snapchat, and you're exactly in that space. So what would it mean? I don't know if you can make a projection, but if you do have a billion faces in your system, what could that mean in terms of revenue potential?
Well,
what would the company be worth? You know, people, I mean, as you know, what's,
yeah,
I mean
people,
what's the valuation?
People do sound pretty stupid when they start projecting revenues off of a billion consumers. I like to sort of see the world in building blocks. We have, and we'll go through this in our longer presentation. We had $0 in revenues in the second quarter of 2019. We had roughly $6 million in revenues in the third quarter of 2019. We are able to confirm guidance. One of our subsidiaries released numbers across Europe for a particular reason. So I'm comfortable saying we'll do $49 million in revenues in the fourth quarter, up from six the prior quarter. And so that puts us at a $200 million run rate in revenues. Now, some of the risk on that number are differences between gross revenues and net revenue accounting between Europe and the United States, but as we work that out in our year-end audit, I mean, we've got substantial revenues now. And the biggest reason we bought those companies in Europe is because they have a digital distribution platform into 180 countries. So we're now in 180 countries. We have 400 million customers in our database, 14 million active subscribers of our digital commerce platform. We collect money in 140 different currencies. So I haven't been focused on revenues. I've been focused on building the infrastructure for this very, very big idea. So we're not just one of those apps that says, hey, we're going to take over the world because we're going to go viral. We built the infrastructure first, right? We bought a digital content solutions platform that's in 180 countries and 140 currencies. And so whether Floyd Mayweather versus Sugar Ray Leonard, you know, I don't need to pay somebody to put me in front of customers in Argentina to collect money in that local currency and to make sure I remit taxes appropriately. So it's like we built the warehouse first, almost, if you were thinking of us like an Amazon.
Okay. And that
so
business and
we've
that business is doing 200 million
employees around the world. We've got a $200 million revenue run rate. We've got a digital distribution platform that allows any of what we do in 2020 and beyond to be seen now in 180 countries and 140 currencies. To get to your question, because I don't want to dodge the question, I think our revenue growth is probably going to come largely through acquisition in 2020. I mean, I think we're going to grow. The revenue growth that we have off of our core business depends on exactly when projects come online, like the Floyd Mayweather project or some of the stuff we're going to be announcing next week, or when exactly does Kung Fu Panda launch in late 2020, how did the sponsorship revenues come in on that project and that type of thing. So 2020 in terms of organic growth is, I think, going to be attractive, but it depends on when some of these projects kick in, because an August start date versus a November start date or a June start date has a big impact on what you book this year. But let me talk about the numbers. One Kung Fu Panda show resident in one city in Chengdu, China, will kick off $40 million a year of cash flow. Now, as we uplist, that's when we'll determine how much of that do we want to fund out of core capital, how much do we want to get from investors. So it may be our show to control how much of that $40 million of cash flow comes to us versus what we might share with an off-balance sheet investor. So these are the things that are going to have a lot to do with our 2020 numbers. But we're big and we're growing. In terms of acquisition, we've made it very clear. We're going to buy technology. We're going to buy content, intellectual property. And we're also going to buy companies that bring us audience. We're looking at one company right now with over $500 million in revenues, $140 million in operating cash flow. And you can buy them for 3x cash flow, when under us, they would probably trade for 15x cash flow. So acquisitions are interesting because, like, high growth technology companies can buy traditional entertainment companies very cheaply and accretively, such that it has a profoundly positive impact on our stock price, because traditional media companies are becoming devalued in a world that's dominated by technology disruptors. So if I can buy a media company with a whole bunch of cash flow, and maybe they already have 500 million, you know, consumers, and they trade for a ridiculously low multiple because everybody wants to talk about Netflix, you know, that's the kind of thing that you should also expect to see us do. Now, why would a company like that want to sell to a little company like us? Look at our shareholder group. Look at our technology. Look at our IP. Forget the fact that we're an OTC company. We're only an OTC company because we wanted to buy a technology portfolio that was already in an OTC company. So we're qualified to uplist right now. We're moving forward with that right now. And traditional media companies see business models like ours as being more valuable than theirs. And Jack, I'm really sorry to go on, but I want to explain why. A traditional media company touches their consumer intermittently throughout the year. They'll sell you a ticket to a show, a ticket to a game, a ticket to a movie. So they may have hundreds of millions of customers who know who they are, but they only see them 3 or 4 times a year. Whereas, and they have great IP and great content, but a bad business model. Then you look at Netflix, which, let's admit it, they've got pretty crappy content, but we're all addicted to it. So bad IP with a great business model, because Netflix finds a way to touch us every day. So, and the challenge that Netflix has, which they've been very public about, they've got to upgrade their content to keep people back, because people are getting a little tired of binging on B-minus episodic journeys. So they're putting $14 billion this year into content. So wow. I think what we can do at our company is we can acquire traditional media companies that bring us great IP, great characters, and tons of consumers and an audience. And we can modernize those business models by giving them FaceBank apps to engage with them, you know, every single day. So
This is basically a big IP story. I mean, this is essentially what FaceBank is. I mean, it's like the ultimate IP story.
Yeah, we're a technology-driven IP story, because you will look, I met you, Jack, through some really cool technology companies that I think are probably also making this transition. You know, technology is great. What's the next great thing? VR, AR, XR? You know, I don't know. I'm the best in the world at digital humans, you know, 3 years ago. Maybe we still are today. We're not going to be tomorrow. Technology gets obsolete. But IP lasts a long, long time. And some IP lasts forever. And we want to own the IP. We don't want to be just another sexy technology company that helps us do something really cool and everybody's forgotten us the way they've forgotten about Prodigy and Netscape. You know, I mean, it's today's great technology company is tomorrow's roadkill. But intellectual property lasts sometimes forever.
John, if everything everything works out, where do you see FaceBank 2-3 years from now? Like, what will this company look like? You know, what's your vision for the future of FaceBank?
My vision is about customer aggregation. I mean, I could tell you what, you know, my revenue dreams are, but it's really driven by what our customer reach is. So today, with this announcement that I'm talking about, you know, this week, we will contractually have access to 265 million customers that are going to be seeing FaceBank and hearing about us every month. By the end of 2020, I believe that our customer reach can get to 570 million consumers who are going to hear about and think about and see FaceBank every month. Now, today, we have 6 major celebrities with which we have long-term revenue share agreements. We'd like that to be 50 by the end of 2020. So our celebrity catalog is going to grow by dozens over the course of 2020. Some of those celebrities are going to be ready to put their digital likenesses in a project right away. Some of them are going to sit there and think about it for years. But every one of them is obligated to tell consumers, hey, my face is important. I'm with FaceBank. You should be too. So imagine the world of the Jennifer Lopez's and the Shakira's. Those are my two favorites from the Super Bowl. And, you know, even the Elvis's of the world, like promoting FaceBank to consumers, because our ultimate goal, we have zero consumer faces scanned today because we're just launching our consumer apps. We want 50 million faces loaded up in the FaceBank by the end of 2020. And we'd like 1 billion faces by the end of 2025. So what's the value of our company at that stage? It's a lot. It's more about how many consumers we're meeting. And you mentioned Snapchat and some other big ones a moment ago. And so before we get discouraged that, oh, boy, there are other big guys out there and they're all well-funded. Well, think of who we are. I think we're everybody's favorite partner. We're the people that are out aggregating consumers, getting their faces, getting them to trust us with their digital assets so that the Microsofts and the Snapchats and others can come to us and say, hey, John, you got 300 million faces. Are they interested in our new Xbox platform? Because if they trust me with their face, because we protect it for them, and you can have fun with your face, but you're not going to lose your face. Well, we're the bank, right? When you want to use your face, we help you lend it out. That positions us to be partners with all these great companies that would otherwise run over us. Why didn't Facebook protest our trademark when it was granted to us in 2017?
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
I don't know.
That's an interesting guy.
But hey, look, they were pretty cool. I think people know that our business model is, I think the big guys really like us. They want us to succeed. We're going to aggregate customers, protect them into a fully consensual environment where, you know, we're going to give those customers over to the Googles and the Facebooks. And we're the aggregator of those consumers that are now going to be able to use us to engage with those companies and activate their faces in those apps. You can download your face into the video games of Xbox. We're going to serve it up for you. So when people say, well, who's your competitor? I'm like, I don't know. Show me a company in the world is doing this.
Excellent.
We're
John,
trying to do it to be everybody's friend.
I know,
consumer's friend and the strategic partner's friend.
John, I know that you have some meetings and that you're going to be on a tight schedule. So I want to ask you one last question. Which is, you know, what we always ask at the end of these interviews. In your opinion, what are the top three reasons why investors should consider FaceBank stock today?
You know, I always like following smart money, right? I mean, I don't know that you're going to find many OTC companies that have shareholders like, oh, I forgot to mention one, SoftBank, Tencent Holdings, the Lego Corporation, Highlight Communications, three other individuals that I would just put in the, you know, global billionaire category. So Original Force Animation out of China, Shanghai United Games. So, I don't think there are a lot of OTC companies that have our kind of institutional backing. And, you know, we talk about them publicly and we'll have to talk about them publicly because they're not going to show up necessarily in institutional ownership because, you know, none of them really own over 5%. But you'll see us engaging with those companies and announcing strategic transactions with those companies starting next week. Secondly, you know, our market cap around $250 million, I helped develop that digital domain, a software package called Nuke, which was an enterprise visual effects software package. It sold for $300 million. I think what we're doing here with our character animation and our facial rigging systems, I think our software alone and helping to create characters for games or movies, I think our software alone would sell for more than Nuke sold for, and Nuke sold for $300 million. I think our rights agreements, you know, what's the face of Michael Jackson worth as he hopefully clears his, you know, publicity issues today and his show I hope does well as it opens up in New York. But, you know, the Michael Jackson contract, I think, is worth, you know, our market cap, our relationships with ABBA and Elvis and Marilyn Monroe and Muhammad Ali, all of these, you know, you've got to, on a discounted cash flow basis, ascribe some value to. You know, what happens with Kung Fu Panda? Right now we own only 2.4% of Kung Fu Panda across Asia, but we've made it very clear we think we can own 25 to 50% of that by the end of 2020. So You know, I think our market cap looks very expensive to a lot of people that are used to trading penny stocks, but it's not the stock price that matters. It's the market value that matters against the assets. Our shareholder equity, our book value, appraised and audited, is, you know, $230 million currently. And we're really just at the beginning of our revenue growth and our consumer ramp up. So from, you know, zero to 6 million to 49 million in revenues in just the last three quarters, I think we're, you know, I think it's a good time to support us.
Well, John, on that note, I want to thank you. And we look forward to your presentation next week. Anybody listening to this interview is obviously invited to join the presentation, engage in Q&A, and you know, decide for yourself. Click the link that you're going to see on the page to register for free. John, thank you, and we'll see you next week.
Well, Jack, I really appreciate it, and I do want to reiterate that. I mean, I can't stand listening to me talk, and I certainly don't think, you know, me talking is going to tell you anything about our business. Next week, we're going to show you how we build a digital human. We're going to show you how we've evolved and how they are used. And I can tell you it is a lot of fun. We've given this presentation from, you know, here to, you know, conferences, you know, across Europe and in the Middle East and Asia. So I'm really looking forward to sharing it with your audience. And if you never buy a share of our stock, you're going to be able to tell people you saw how Iron Man was built. And I'm really looking forward to it.
Perfect. Thank you, John.